that you want coffee? I would like to come in and read the Word of God. Now look, if you are on your way to heaven, and I am on the way to hell, what do you think to you?
Can't do it. We'll do it live. No. We'll do it live. Do it live. I'll write it and we'll do it live. And thing sucks.
And WBAI, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. I think you guys are doing a terrific job. There's some wonderful people overnight. I think Matt Schneeb is brilliant and Arpo Martin is brilliant, but I don't know how many people get to hear them. And I want to say thanks. That's a tremendous job.
Well, thank you very much for that.
Get without going over, so it's Halloween time in the dustbin of history. What have we got for you today? Truett and George, Ghost Dance, 1927. Well, time to turn to Gene Shepherd, Lost Episode, 1963, Halloween Night. It's a potpourri, a wild conglomeration of materials, so let's hear it. Not available anywhere else, but right here in the dustbin of history, WBAI, New York.
They've got the right idea. They think it's great to refrigerate while we all cremate down here. Just be like those bamboo babies.
the tune you all been retting it and asking for, and I'm certainly pleased to sing it for you. One, two, three, four. One night I was listening to the Grand Ole Opry and listening to Roy Acuff singing. I picked up my catalog and said to my daddy, I'm on to buy myself a guitar tonight. I waited 3 weeks by the mailbox. I waited 3 long weeks. You want to hear the rest of that? It's a good tune there. Oh, there's also another one that I'd like to do for you some night. Cigarettes and whiskey and well, women will be. All of their gang. He always sings raggedy music through the cattle as he swings back and forward in the saddle on a horse, pretty good horse, syncopated, gated, and there's such a funny meter to the roar of his feet, how they run. When they hear that fella's gun, because the western folks all know he's a highfalutin toot, son of a gun from Arizona. Ragtime cowboy, talk about your cowboys. Ragtime cowboy, Joe. All together, gang. Rack-a-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. Rack-a-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. All right, Eddie. Very good. Very good. Very good. We're all set. We're all set. You know, the little kid came up to me tonight, and he was wearing a Frankenstein face. First, I thought it was one of the salesmen. And you know how they get after 14 hours over there in Le Marmiton? Yeah, you know, it's a funny thing. They you know, that strange look, like they've been resurrected from the dead. And, yeah, you know, Frankenstein's monster. And this little squirt came along, and he's got little bolts coming onto the side of his head. And he was about 3.5 feet tall, if that. And the head was at least 1.5 feet tall. And he comes walking down this big thing on him. And he has a gunny sack over him. And he has, over the gunny sack, he has his father's coat turned backwards, you know, with his arms coming out. And the coat is in the front and the buttons are in the back, you know, giving that flat front look. And he was wearing 2 large galoshes. And these big galoshes were backwards. And he is sloshing along, this little squirt. He's not more than 3 feet high. Of all plays, I see this guy in a supermarket. He's walking around the frozen food department with a Frankenstein face. And he comes up to me, he says, "Twick or tweet?" And I look at him, and it suddenly hit me. You know, my whole life has been trick or treat. My whole life has been a succession of guys, ranging all the way from little 3.5 foot guys wearing rubber Frankenstein monster hats to Bob Leader himself, coming up to me with that look in the eye, "Trick or treat, Dad." Trick or treat, pay up. Yes, that is true. Life is a series of trick or treat events. And of course, most of us are not capable of treating. So we get, well, what we pay for. Which is, we get the revolving door spins, and you get hurled out in the Sixth Avenue on your thing. Well, we're all says, you know, a lot of things to report on this Thursday night. Oh, fellow sufferers. Boing. I'm going to have to bring my guitar in here some night to really bedevil the troops. This balalaika scares them too much, because the trouble with balalaika is everybody thinks you're not playing it because it's got such a peculiar... Yeah, oh, yes, it's written on a completely different series. It's a very different scale, you know, so everyone thinks you're just fooling around with it until they grab it. The other day, Walter Kiernan grabbed it by the neck and says, "Watch this." He's going to knock out 2 quick choruses of "Yes, Sir, That's My Baby." And then his hand got caught in the thing, and he stuck.
Yes, sir, that's my baby.
Doesn't quite work, Walter. It's not in this. It's a, you know, some people are never quite in the accepted scale. It's a problem. You know, that's one good thing about music and writing sonnets and things. There is a form. There is a definite form. And has it ever occurred to you that mankind himself, people, if you are in tune, If you fall within the octave scale, everyone thinks you're okay. You're singing the right song. And you're singing with the right notes. Now, you'll not find that note on your guitar, Dad. Listen to this one. That ain't a Sears Roebuck Model 17 Spanish type. Steel. It is not. It's very different. Well, now, there are people who do not fall within the scale of values of the accepted mankind race, the song that we all sing. You know that. Just don't fit. Like Nixon. You know, some guys try to sing the song, but it doesn't come out right. It's like, you know, it's like you've been trained under the scale of value. You know, speaking of scales of values, and there are a lot of things to talk about tonight, a lot of things to feel if you are of such a mind. And I'm not here to make any suggestions, but one thing I would like to say here at this juncture is that many things are in a period, a tremendous transition now. And whatever you see around you, it's either growing or it's diminishing. It's either growing or it's going down. The only thing I suppose that is exempt in a way from that is a very large rock. But even very large rocks are being eroded minutely day after day after day. And I have a sneaking suspicion now, and I have evidence too to prove it, that already the folk music craze is on its way out. I have a suspicion too of what's going to replace it, but I think that the folk music craze is on its way out. And right here I have the evidence. This is going into my giant file of trivia from Playboy magazine. Speaking of trivia, here is the first the ad, the first one that shows that the beginning of the end is about to happen. You see a couple of jovial singing types. One of them has his back to the camera, and the other has her little things to the camera. And they're standing there, and he's got a guitar. There's two of them there. He's wearing one of those hats, the funny little hats with the beer kegs on the side. Or maybe it's got a little tee and a little couple of golf balls on the top, or a couple of clubs. Well, here's what the copy reads. You can be first with the authentic Hootenanny humming and strumming society cotton sweater. Hootenanny is a folk singing get-together. Hootenanny sessions are sweeping the country, and this is the official Hootenanny shirt. The only one available. Act quickly, friends. If you want to be the first, she'll want one as much as you do. The Latin insignia over her heart on that sweatshirt, the Hootenanny sweatshirt, reads, folk music is an art form. Show you belong. Get yours now. It's the beginning of the end. The beginning.
She's got eyes of blue. I never cared for eyes of blue, but she's got eyes of blue, and that's my weakness now. Oh, she's got dimpled cheeks. I never cared for dimpled cheeks, but she's got dimpled cheeks,
and that's my weakness now.
Oh, my,
oh, my,
oh,
my,
oh, me, oh, me, oh, my.
Oh, it should be good, I would be good, but gee, oh, my,
wow, 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 wow. She likes to bill and coo. I never liked to be.
That's enough. Them American folk songs. Well, it's the beginning of the end. I hated it. I Peter, Paul, and Mary just about had it, friends. Have you ever noticed that almost all folk singers are inordinately lugubrious and exceedingly doleful? And even when singing about joy, they do so with the joy of an ancient wet mop. I'm here tonight to sing of fun, to sing of joy and gladness. I'm here tonight to sing of kicks. I'm here tonight to swing, 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 my love, swing, swing, my love. I'm here tonight to sing of joy and love and freedom and kicks and happiness. I'm here tonight. That boy, that'll show Godfrey. Speaking of trouble, let's see this. Oh yes, this is WORAM at FM New York. There's a closey there. And Eddie, I think you better get that. Yeah, get the sinister stuff out there already. There, we're ready to go. It's going to happen tonight. You know, this is Halloween. I see little signs in the wings. Little things are coming out from behind the curtain. Here, for example, is a store. In Brooklyn. Doesn't matter. A store in Brooklyn here. Any of them. Just, don't get into an ideological argument in there. What cut? Believe me, that's one thing about Oriental music and folk music. They ain't much difference. They just go on and on. You just holler freedom while you got a folk song going. And in Oriental tunes there, you just stamp your foot loud. And you got something going there. Well, speaking of something going in Brooklyn, for those of you who wonder how the wind is blowing tonight and how Halloween is making the scene, in Brooklyn there is a store. I have the ad here. And they're having a big Halloween costume contest. All the kids are supposed to come. And down at the bottom of the ad, it tells the rules of the contest. They're giving a very special prize for the best girl who comes as a boy and the best boy who comes as a girl. Chucky is the judge. I'd like to tell you about Mandarin House. If you don't know about really good Oriental food, it's a very good Oriental food, and particularly if you've never tried Mandarin food, I would most highly recommend. In fact, I think what I'm going to do, I think I might as well do it. I think I'm going to try to get LJ on the phone, and I think tomorrow night he and I are going to go up to the 2nd Avenue one, just off of 57th Street, and lay in a supply of twice-cooked pork. But if you have not tried Mandarin food, Dad, do it, quick. They've got a good bar. They're open over the weekend. It's a great place for a luncheon and a dinner, and particularly for a weekend thing for the whole family. And it's Mandarin, and one is on 13th Street between 6th and 7th, and the other is up on 2nd Avenue just off of 57th Street. Hey, hey, well, Strange Red, the Dragon, just leave. End of Mandarin House commercial tent. Gee, you just got that in. I'm a rotten person. I'm telling you. Sometimes I can just see it. It just scares the daylights out of me sometimes. Thinking of standing up before that final bar of eternal justice, and this great figure is looking down at me, and I appear, my knees knocking, and looks down, this great bearded figure, and the clouds are swirling. Mr. Shepherd, we would like to look over the record. And, of course, about all I could say is, well, all my dues are paid up. I whip out all my union cards and say, well, I'm all paid up, SAG, Equity, AFM, AGVA. I start taking out all my cards that they're all punched. I got all the right things. We are not talking about your union dues. If you will pause just a moment, we are going to reach back in our eternal great collection of records and take out a few significant tapes. We are going to play them for you. And in just a moment, we will return.
Here's a bulletin from the WOR newsroom. A power plant exploded at the Indiana State Fairgrounds Coliseum during the Holiday on Ice review show tonight. Police Lieutenant John Hartnett said about 15 persons were killed and 50 were injured. Stay tuned right here to WOR Radio for further details. Now back to Gene Shepherd.
I've been in that Coliseum, that State Fair Coliseum. It's a very scary story. And if anything comes in, they'll put it on. You know, it is a funny thing, Halloween and all the attendant things that go on with it. Do you know that certain cities celebrate Halloween? I've noticed the thing, maybe it's because I've lived in several American cities, and I've come to believe that most people don't really live in other cities. Many people have visited cities, you know, Ed. You guys have gone to San Francisco for a week, or they've gone to Toledo once on their way through to visit their aunt, that kind of stuff. But I, because of the business that I've been in, have lived, literally lived in several cities and lived with the, you know, the peculiar feeling that this is like going to be permanent for a while. And then all of a sudden you pack up and you go, usually with loud cries of people chasing you down to the station to see that you get on that train. But nevertheless, do you know that there are at least, I know of at least one city that celebrates Halloween the way New York celebrates Christmas. You know, Christmas is a big deal in New York. They have parades and the whole scene here in New York. Well, I will give you the brass figlegee if you can tell me the name of the American city that celebrates Halloween. It's a gigantic celebration in the city. Has nothing to do, by the way, with Mardi Gras, any of that kind of stuff. It is a giant Halloween celebration. And, in fact, the celebration is so big that the main street, just the way it is here in New York during the big Christmas parade, the main street of this city, it's a big American city, is blocked off, and the whole population, or those who want to take part in it, take part in this gigantic Halloween celebration. Now, I was amazed. The first time I saw this, I couldn't believe it. You know, most places, Halloween is just one of those things. Most people don't pay much attention to it. Even the kids around, the kids do a little bit of it. But most people just don't. Although I will say this, when I was a kid, this maybe is a Midwestern thing. It is not Chicago. It's a city. I'm not talking about Chicago. When I was a kid, the big deal for my mother and father, and it used to give me a very vague feeling of something a little obscene going on. They would have, yes, they would go somewhere for a gigantic Halloween party, and they would go in costume. And then after that, this was one of two holidays that the men of any party or any group of people, the men would go to a special midnight show at this wild whoopee theater that they had in Chicago, where men would go to a special midnight show for all these things, you know. There'd be a big ad in the paper. It's a special Halloween midnight show tonight. And there'd be bubbles, you know, they always show bubbles and little witches flying among the bubbles, people tooting horns, and then you see Longstreet, you know, those crummy little ads. And then it would show a girl standing in the foreground, a naked girl holding a big bubble over her, and it says, "Yes, men, special adults only midnight show tonight." Well, that was a big deal in Chicago. I don't know whether they still do it or not. But the city that does that, it doesn't matter, because Halloween and holidays mean different things to different cities. It really, this is not a solitary, solid country. This is not a country. There's no homogeneity in this country at all. And I was amazed when I came to New York, for example, to find out that St. Patrick's Day was a big deal. It's hardly mentioned in most other cities. It's just one of those days, you know. It's St. Patrick. Nobody says much about it. Here in New York, it's one of the gigantic holidays. And I could never get over in New York. I'm still not used to Columbus Day being celebrated the way it's celebrated in New York. Columbus Day is like one of those things out in the Midwest, like Arbor Day. Nobody gets out and marches around with a tree and holds leaves and things, and they all march down and plant a tree, nothing. But it's just one of those holidays that people don't pay much attention to. But here in the East, there are big celebrations. And out in the Midwest, on the other hand, there are several holidays that are hardly celebrated here, among them Halloween. Oh, yeah, that's funny. Ed looks kind of confused there. As Of course, they have the real answer here. Well, you know, they have got a lot of real answers here. I'm standing here about 20 minutes ago. I'm looking in a drugstore. You know, the kind of drugstore that has all toys. It's got little mechanical bartenders that you wind up. It's got the juicers and transistor radios. You know, that kind of drugstore. And in the middle of the center window, they have a display of these transparent men. You know those things, magic transparent men, $9.98 or something. And next to that that big collection of transparent men, there was a collection of transparent women. It says transparent women, miracle transparent women, and miraculous. Well, of course, that's interesting. I have yet to find a transparent woman. They are pretty shifty. But nevertheless, there it was. Maybe this is a dream of glory on somebody's part. But you can buy a transparent woman. And there in the middle of the box is a little square window. You know, it's got a little special. You can see the transparent woman in there. And then on the outside of it was a little red banner. And the banner said, extra optional feature, the miracle of creation. It's very heady, primal stuff. The miracle of creation comes as an extra optional feature. Sadly enough, the truth had come out again. That's also true of a lot of women. It's an extra optional feature that comes in a very expensive way. You know, while we're speaking of very expensive things, and I was, again, reminded tonight of sitting around there, and I'm reading a Newswire story of a guy that had a terrible failure. And failure's an interesting subject, Eddie. How many of us are complete, absolutely complete? We can do everything except one very important thing. And you spend the rest of your life trying to find out what that thing, what is that magic ingredient that you've missed? What is it that, why is it that all the things you can do look, you walk around good, you got clear eyes, Ed, you know, you stand up straight, you smoke a cigar with a plum, you do everything right. But here we're both sitting at this hour at night doing this trivial stuff. Dean Atchison isn't, you know. Adlai Stevenson is somewhere else. What happened? Well, I remember learning a lesson, a really great lesson of failure. This is one of the reasons why I'm a great sport fan. Watching things go on the ball diamond, or watching them go on out on the football field, you begin to see some of the real stories of life spelled out in a way that you just can't see in real life, because people can fake in real life, you know? You can fake it all up. You can get yourself a good suit. Guys get themselves a hairpiece. And you know, they get themselves an answering service on the telephone. Other guys learn how to speak loud. They take the Dale Carnegie course. They're faking it up. And it's pretty hard to tell the phonies from the real ones. But boy, when you see it happen out on the ball diamond, you know, and it is spelled out in letters that are unmistakable. Well, one time, and I'm delighted to report that this was a shortstop for the Chicago Cubs, there was a famous shortstop. I will award you a brass figurine with bronze oak leaf palm, if you can tell me his name. He played with the Giants. And I can remember every couple of months I would hear on the radio that the Giants are now playing the Chicago Cubs. And the Cubs were a real powerful team in those days. Oh, yeah, they were a tough ball club. They were winning pennants and stuff. And the Giants, of course, were a tough ball club. And every couple of months, this club would come. And this famous shortstop would be playing. Of course, he was famous like all the rest of the Giants. But we did not know in Chicago at the time what he was famous for. He was just a famous shortstop. And then inexplicably, without any explanation, he was traded to the Cubs. Well, I couldn't figure it out. You know, it's like all of a sudden if the Yankees decide just out of the blue they're trading Cletus Boyer or something. You know, the guys wonder, what's happened? Why, you know, I thought he was such a great third baseman. Well, it turned out why he was. I'm this patrol boy, you see, and I'm getting free tickets to see the ball game. And the Cubs were opening the season, and they invited a lot of patrol boys, and I would only go to the Cubs if it was free. I hated the Cubs. And there's, you know, it's like, really it is, it's like a Met fan at a Yankee game. I mean, you just hate the Yankees. That's all there is to it. And it's an unreasoning, blind hatred. It's prejudice. I think it's connected with racial prejudice. No, it's all those subtle things. Unreasoning, blind hatred of that uniform. Well, the Cubs always had kind of cutie pie uniforms. It's a cutie pie ballpark. It really is. It's a true cutie pie park. It has nothing to do with baseball. They've got vines, for example, little vines. It's like a little old lady has planted vines and morning glories and little phloxes and things all around the outfield. Oh, yeah. Oh, for crying. Hack Wilson, a Chicago Cub outfielder, was lost in the vines for 2.5 days one time, right in the pennant race. Well, of course, he had a snoot full, so that was another story. That's one of the reasons. Well, that's another story. But, no, it's the truth. So you'd go out there, and they had these cutie little suits, the Cubs did. You know, the White Sox had dirty, rotten ball suits, you know, baseball uniforms, all torn and dirty and gray. Of course, they were in last place all those years, and they couldn't afford new suits. They had the same suits that the Black Sox wore. Do you know that they didn't change uniforms in the Chicago White Sox until the fall of 48? They had the same suits the shoeless Joe Jackson wore. And, of course, they were worn and tattered and patched and gray. But you go out to see the Cubs, and they've got cute little uniforms. I'll tell you what they were like. They were like pajamas that girls wear. You know, when they're being cute, you know, with the little knee-length things. And they had cute ball players. It really makes you mad. You know, the Yankees have got cute ball players. That really bugs a Met fan. You know, after a whole season of those bow-legged, tough little Met players that are going nowhere but kicking up a lot of dust, to see a guy like, you know, chiseled profile of Roger Maris out there. And Bobby, what's his name at second there? Bobby Richardson, who looks, oh, really, there's a gommy. Face. He's right out of a Class B movie starring Dick Foran, you know, and it really bugs you. Well, that's the kind of thing used to make the White Sox fans mad. First of all, you'd go out to the Cubs Park and you could see the game. You see, they were on the north side where the sun shone. And the sun would come down. Yeah, and we were on the south side where there was nothing but on one side, the L&N freight yards. And, of course, all those smokestacks are blowing the stuff right down across home plate over third. And then on the other side was the stockyards. What they were blowing into the ballpark, I can't even tell you at this hour with the kids up. I don't know whether you've played ball for 25 years next to a stockyards, but it was wild. So you'd sit out there, and it was really, the crossed wind would come. First one shot, you'd get it from the stockyards, and you'd sit there for about 30 seconds, your eyeballs are turning yellow, and then there would be, the wind would change, it's the windy city, you know, and you'd get the freight yards, the L&N hump is blowing it in, and you'd get the cinders and the clinkers, and you could see the dim figure of Banana Nose Zeke out there waving at another one as it whistles down the line. Well, you know, so it was very difficult. Have you ever wondered why all the White Sox have such low batting averages? Well, it's the air out there. They got very thick air in Comiskey Park. Roger Maris never hits home runs in Comiskey Park. The ball bounces off the air. You just hit it up there and it bounces back. Well, the Cubs Park had this clean air, you know, everything's clean. So you sit out and you kind of resent it. It's like, you know, you come out in the light. It's like dragging a whole bunch of guys from McDougal Street and putting them on 57th Street in the bright sunlight, you know, and out in front of something like, yeah, you know, or stand them out in front of the Time Life building. So it looks a bit terrible, you know. Well, I went out there and I'm this kid and I'm watching the Cubs play. Now, this is not a baseball story. It's a story about failure, ladies. So you stay tuned. And I'm sitting there, and there's that shortstop. He really was something. This guy could cover, I'll tell you, he could cover the entire territory between second base and third. He just covered, he was like a spider. He was fantastic. He was like a streak. And he was a little sort of a short, wiry, he was what they call a holler guy. A great glove man, and he was a pretty good hitter. And he's out there, come on, let's go! You could hear him all the way up into the, you know, we're sitting way up there, back of first base, and you could hear him yelling, let's go! And the Cubs are really moving around back. Stan Hack is on third, you know, a great third baseman. Billy Herman is on second, and this clown is moving back and forth like a tiger between second and third. Well, there's a shot, goes pow! It goes up, two quick hops over the grass, into the dirt, and he dives. Eddie, this guy dove, he made a stop,
the kind of stop that you're just unbelievable. Defies gravity. He slides in the dirt. That glove shoots up. You hear that? And the batter, of course, has got a startled look on his face, and he's tearing for first. With that, the guy gets up. He spins around, and he's got the runner by 15 feet. A fantastic stop. He winds up, pow, into the upper deck. Upper deck, that shot went, and I'm a kid, you know, I'm sitting up in the upper deck. It was the closest I've come to a ball in a ballpark. I mean, hit foul balls. Whoop! The ball goes past me. Boonk! It hits a seat, bounces down, back on the field, and the guy's on third base by the time the yelling stopped. Well, of course, there's a lot of yelling out there, and the people are cheering. Well, fantastic. They didn't know whether to cheer for the fantastic stop or boo the throw. So the third inning is now going on. The Cubs are trailing by two. There is a guy on third base. Pow! Another shot. This guy goes ranging over to second. He dives a fantastic shot. He dives down in the dirt. He comes up with it. There's two outs. He spins. He lets that shot go. This guy had the hardest arm you ever saw. He lets that throw. Whoop! Over the dugout. Woo! Whistles past the guy selling hot dogs and out on Ashland Avenue. Whoa! Just like that. Well, now the Cubs knew why he was traded. This guy could do everything but throw. He could throw like a bullet. Somehow he could not aim it. Well, the stories began to appear. The story said every morning now the shortstop is out 2.5 hours before everybody else, and the manager, Charlie Grimm, all of his special assistants are out there, and they're practicing throws to first. And what they would do, they'd lay down a bunt, and he'd come in, boom, boom, he'd scoop it up, pick it up, boom, right on the bag. He was great in practice, right on the bag. You know, he had that arm like a bullet, boom, like that. So they practice this for 2.5 hours, and it is now 2 p.m. and game time. The shortstop is ranging like a tiger back there on the grass. They lay down a bunt, boom, boom, picks it up, whoop, upper deck, boom, 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 bounces around. Well, the Chicago Cubs did something that I think should be put in the record book. You've heard for years how they move the fences back and forth for home run hitters, how they cheat a little bit, how for Maury Wills they would let the diamond out there on the West Coast get as hard as a rock so that Maury Wills could move faster. And other ball clubs, when Maury Wills would come to town, they would wet down the diamond and grind it up so that he was knee-deep in mud the instant he got on first. Well, little things are done like that, you know. This was the first ball club in history that put a screen back of the first base dugout so that they could hold the runner to one base. And it was a beautiful sight to see this shortstop ranging to his left towards third. He dives, boom, he picks it up, whips it into the screen. And the catcher, you see, learning to play the carom, plays it on the quick hop, whips it to second and holds the man to a single base. Beautiful play. They actually worked the carom on that. And of course, the Chicago Cub management announced that they were doing this because they were doing it to protect the spectators. My foot! First of all, it was costing them $20 a game for balls that he threw into the stands. Secondly, they lost at least 9 games out of 10 by that extra base. So they were playing the carom. And at that moment, of course, he got so he was really great at that. And he never got over that problem. They would move out, they would leave Wrigley Field, and sure enough, the next day it would say, errors too. Guess who? He could do everything but throw. And this guy could possibly have been in the Hall of Fame, but as a net result, he was just another bad shortstop. Great on going to his left. Great on going to his right. He was a good stick man. He was a good glove man all the way around. But he brained at least 17 spectators in his major league career on that shot the first. Well, I'll award you the brass pig to give if you could tell me who that guy is. Don't tell me they remember him. Oh, boy, there's a real ball fan out there. Yeah, did he say it was true what he did? That's right. And so as a kid, My old man, it was a funny thing about my old man, you know, whenever I would come home from school and I am, say, lousing up on geography, see, and I would be a great hand around spelling. I was one of those real jazzy spellers, you know. I'd say scissors, S-C-I, you know, that kind of real snotty kid. Oh, I hate kids that jump up and start spelling. I would say to my mother, "Mother, do you know how to spell geranium? G-E-R." And she'd say, "Oh, come on." And I was always showing off. Refrigerator, R-E-F-I-G, refrigerator, R-E-F-R-I-G. I was very good at spelling. I was a great shot at reading. I had a little weak spot there in arithmetic from time to time, but something about geography made me black out. I could not get geography. And so my old man used to say to me, "Remember," and he would fill in the name of that fabulous Cub shortstop. He'd say, "Remember," and I would get scared because I knew what had happened. It was a guy that could do everything except one thing that seemed trivial. You know, it seems very trivial to be able to go to your right and make those fantastic stops, to be able to hit, to be able to throw fast, but it seems very trivial to be able to get it to first. That seems so easy, you know, such an easy thing. And I figured, you know, that one day my life would be blighted by my lack of knowledge of meanders, of rivers, and the principal exports of Peru, and the population of Australia. And where the rainforest began and end. Well, actually, it has proven to be that way. Literally. What do you think has blighted my career? Why do you think I've been spending the last 40 years of my life traveling everywhere, looking at the rainforests, looking at the principal crops of Peru, examining the bird life of Tasmania? Fears are awful things. I could tell you more stories about ball players out there and Halloween. Yeah, well, the city I was talking about was Cincinnati. Cincinnati goes ape over Halloween. Don't ask me why. I don't know. There's a real strain of witchcraft though out in the Middle West. And it's, oh, by the way, speaking of witchcraft, this is something I just got to say here. Eddie, get me my special English, thing here. It's very important. This is one of those potpourris tonight. The very special thing. A lot of times, you know, we have, from time to time on this thing, we have discussed the difference between comedy and humor. Americans are great on comedy. It's in the humor field that they begin to find themselves knee-deep in whatever it is that passes for self-importance. It's very, very, we just don't have humor. And I would like to salute tonight, if I may, a superb example of English humor. If there's anything that Americans do, we take our industry seriously. You know, it's interesting. I can come on here and I can blaspheme the church. I can yell about politicians. I get no angry calls. If I said one rotten thing about General Motors, I could feel the ground shake underneath me here. That's the truth. Because actually, that's the true religion. You know, that our business in a way here in America is it transcends almost any other belief that we've got. And in fact, I've been thinking of slogans that we should put on dimes. I thought one good slogan for the new dime is "For those who think young." I kind of like that one. I also thought "What's good for General Motors is good." That's a nice slogan. And it makes a lot of sense. But the British are not quite like that. I would like to read to you the beginning paragraphs of an advertisement for a British product that appears in this week's New Yorker. Okay.
And once again, the BBC brings you a night salute to the British. British attitudes, British humor, and the British industry on parade. And now, a British commercial. Due to the growing popularity of the Land Rover in the commission of grand theft, an interim report seems in order. Apparently, our four-wheel drive vehicle has latent virtues which may be of interest to the prospective owner. It is not our intent here to point out raffish ways for one to pick up a great deal of extra money in one's spare time. Rather the opposite to abet law and order by useful suggestion. For instance, in two recent major crimes, land rovers were most helpful in hauling away £2,500,000 and £90,000 respectively. Now, although it is well known that the police of the United Kingdom also employ land rovers, nowhere is it reported that the police employed them on these occasions for hot pursuit of the brigands. Perhaps that is their mistake. The first theft, widely if grudgingly admired for its sheer bulk of loot, was of course the great train robbery which brought the title back to England. These Olympics of knavery took place, you'll recall, at Cheddington, just 5 miles out of Leighton Buzzard, Bedfordshire, on August 8th, last a Thursday. Nearly a week passed before any clues turned up. Then on Tuesday 13, a Times of London article, Dateline Brill, Buckinghamshire, reported, a lonely farm horse near here, 12 miles from Oxford, was the hideout for the mail train gang and their haul of £2,500,000 in banknotes. Mail bags in 3 abandoned vehicles, an army-type truck, and 2 Land Rovers have been found, but no money. One surmises that the Land Rovers were given the arduous getaway assignment, not for their rugged dependability, but for their capacious rear doors as well. Banknotes in excess of so many tend to be cumbersome. When you are trying to unload literally bags and bags of the stuff, you simply haven't time to aim nicely. It's not like playing darts. No, robbing a train is a very near thing at best. One has to have the tools to do the job right. Paradoxically, another Land Rover feature, its overall outstanding height, caused the thieves to flee the arm. And so, once again, the Land Rover proves its superiority in action. Yes, we would like to point out that bank robbers, trained men, highwaymen of all sorts, have endorsed the Land Rover for its quick getaway and its capacious capacity and its ability to stand rough abuse. There are many bulletproof Rovers now in use by some of the hardest gangs of criminals between here and the Middle East. We salute the satisfied Rover owners and recommend it to you for your next getaway.
Now, that's true. You know, the Land Rover was found as a getaway car. Now, can you imagine a Buick ad? Can you imagine a Buick? The Cosa Nostra says it's Buick every time.
Yes, the Purple Gang in Detroit underlines every time. Pontiac. Yes, the Pontiac, its quick getaway, its dart ability, its wide tread action, its beautiful cornering abilities. And the Purple Gang makes another getaway in the new Tempest.
Well, listen, I'll tell you, do you know that one automobile in America began to be very popular? And in fact, it sold as the result of its well-known use by a famous highwayman, a famous bank robber of the 30s. What was the car that John Dillinger was famous for using? What was the car that John Dillinger and a lot of guys bought him? I remember my old man looking at one going past. He says, that might be Dillinger. Boom! This thing would go past. Dillinger was famous for the use of that car, and the car's sales went up because of it.
This is WOR Radio.
That's it. That's the end of the music here. All these grand Pennsylvania songs, and it's been a great pleasure to sing them and, play them for you. And now it's, looking at my little watch here. It's time for me to get down to the Dead Man's Ball, do a little boogie-woogie before the sun rises. And come on, Igor, you too, Gasport. Let's be off. And for the rest of you, in that old Transylvania way, we'll say good night. Whatever you are. Come on, Ego. Come on, Casper. Can't do that like I used to. Bye-bye, whatever you are.
Well, good night, Zach. Good night, listeners. This has been the Dustbin of History. That was Gene Shepherd, Halloween 1963. And we're done. Next week, more Witch's Tale, more Hall of Fantasy, another lost Gene Shepherd here in the Dustbin of History. I'm your curator and janitor, Max Mishmead. And we're going to forego our regular outro and just...